You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello. My guest today is Jacob Sherko, Professor of Law at the College of Law and a specialist in genomic biology at the University of Illinois. His research focuses on the legal and ethical implications of advanced biotechnologies, especially as related to intellectual property. He's a leading expert on IP protection for genome editing technologies, including CRISPR. Today's subject is HeLa cells. These cells come from a line of fast-producing cancer cells that were taken from the tumour of a patient who died of cervical cancer at Johns Hopkins Hospital in 1951 in Baltimore. These cells reproduce at such a rate that they've been described as immortal, and they've touched all corners of medical research and therapy in the past 7 decades. They've formed the basis of the polio vaccine. They've helped with research into IVF and infertility, as well as HIV. They were of tremendous importance to medicine then and medicine now. Professor Sherko, are you happy with me calling you Jacob in the interview, by the way?
Oh, no, please.
Many thanks for agreeing to come on to LawPod UK to discuss this case with us. Could we start with the legal action taken by Henrietta Lacks' estate against the pharmaceutical company concerned in October?
Yeah, sure. So recently in the United States District Court for the District of Maryland, the executor, who happens to be her grandson of Henrietta Lacks, filed a complaint, which is the petition here in the United States that kicks off a lawsuit with a single cause of action against Thermo Fisher, one of the manufacturers of HeLa cells and a bunch of related technologies that either use HeLa cells or incorporate them in some fashion. And the complaint had a single cause of action. There's only one legal claim. And the legal claim is unjust enrichment, which is a common law cause of action here in the United States. It's actually a pretty diverse category of torts.
And am I correct in understanding that the remedy sought is disgorgement of patents and profits as a result of this unjust enrichment?
So the complainants are seeking damages. Whether they're seeking damages that is tethered to disgorgement, or whether it's a royalty, or whether it's damages that are compensatory for harm, is not entirely clear from the complaint. Here in the United States, when filing a federal lawsuit, one must also file what seems like a pro forma cover sheet to go with it that lists the names of the attorneys and the attorneys' phone numbers and their addresses. In addition, to the extent that monetary damages are sought, they must be listed on this cover sheet. And although it was not otherwise included in the complaint in this dollar figure, the amount of damages sought on the cover sheet to the complaint was $10 billion. So that probably exceeds whatever the disgorgement remedy would have probably been. So perhaps that gives some insight that this is potentially punitive, or maybe it's disgorgement, or maybe it's compensatory. It's not entirely clear. I imagine that the remedies portion of this, that is to the extent we'll ever get to the remedies portion of this, will be whittled down as we approach trial.
What is the wrong? Is it lack of informed consent from Henrietta Lacks herself?
Yeah. So again, it is not crystal clear from the complaint exactly what the harm is. I think it's maybe helpful at this point to kind of characterize what the allegations are. And the allegations are essentially that Henrietta Lacks did not have informed consent or was not provided informed consent, depending upon whether you're using the verb in the transitive or the intransitive fashion. It's actually a kind of a big debate in the bioethics circles. But that she didn't provide informed consent with respect to using her samples for research. And then in addition, that more of her tissue was taken than otherwise was medically necessary because the physicians at the time knew that they would be useful for research. And that by doing so, by essentially creating this business model around the immortal cell line, that was a harm in and of itself for which her estate is seeking damages.
And I think we need to make it clear at this stage that this tissue sample was taken while she was still alive. It wasn't taken after her death. And that's important from I speak from an English lawyer's perspective, because in this country we have the Human Tissue Act that was introduced after the Alder Hey and Bristol Royal Infirmary scandals about the retention of body parts, particularly organs, of babies who died in hospital. And the position in this country under the new act, or the relatively new act, is that informed consent must be given by the parents, or in the case of an adult, advanced consent must be given. But the problem here, and I'm sure this applies in the States, is that legislators and indeed courts are very reluctant to get in the way of medical research, so that there are all sorts of exclusions to the requirement for informed consent. Is that the same in the States?
Yeah. So the general rule here in the United States is that the vast majority of research, for one reason or another, informed consent is required. It's either required because the research being conducted is federally funded. To the extent that it is federally funded, it is almost always the case that it comes under what's known as the common rule, which is essentially a bunch of bioethics principles, informed consent being the most important of them, that federal agencies require their fundees to use in order to maintain federal funding. Beyond that, many research institutions have policies related to informed consent that go above and beyond what the common law requires, or at the very least, what the circumstances of the common rule otherwise dictate here. So it is, or at least it would be, an odd set of circumstances to engage in research of this type for which informed consent is not required. Now that I've said that, there are two nuances here in the United States regarding informed consent. First of all, informed consent is largely a pro forma virtue, if it is anything. That is, if patients fill out an informed consent form, even if it can be empirically demonstrated that they actually do not understand what is happening, or for that matter, to even make this more extreme, that they do not understand what the difference is between being a research subject and being a patient, courts here in the United States have found that the four corners of the contract rule, and that to the extent that the purpose of that contract was to provide informed consent to the patient, then it's informed consent. It's informed consent by notice, as opposed to actual consent. That's the first issue. The second issue goes to remedies. Fine, let's say informed consent was not required. What then? And there have been a number of cases here in the United States that essentially say that to the extent that there is a claim to be made, the claim is between the patient and the physician for compensatory damages, but that there will be no equitable or injunctive remedies against third-party researchers doing anything that they otherwise want to do. That is, patients essentially can't stop their tissue being used for research if the third party, if the downstream researchers, if the third party researchers using that particular tissue had otherwise come by it through, you know, legally above board means, through non-nefarious means. It's almost akin to being a good faith purchaser for value for a particular good. If someone had at least partial title, and if you're a good faith purchaser for value here in the United States, then you have good title. I mean, that's even if later it is found that there are defects in title. It's almost akin to that. It's not a perfect example, but it's almost akin to that.
That's very interesting, because one of the exclusions in the Human Tissue Act is where a line of cells is developed outside the body. And that does not come within the informed consent requirement. And a high court judge can declare deemed consent in such a case. But just moving away from Henrietta Lacks for the moment and looking at the broad picture, what is the situation in the United States regarding my ownership of my body parts?
Yeah. So it is, at least in the United States, an incredibly complex issue, much of which turns on, I hate to put it this way, which body parts we have to be talking about. We have entirely different legal regimes concerning the, quote, ownership and sale and transfer of blood versus sperm versus eggs versus, I don't know, a limb. It is entirely dependent on those. More broadly speaking, I think when people think of bodily ownership in the property sense, as opposed to the Lockean sense, the statute that governs it here in the United States, which is has essentially been adopted by almost every state, because just as a reminder to those listening who are not U.S. trained lawyers, you know, we have a federal system, so we have essentially 50 states, 50 jurisdictions making their own rules about substantive matters like this, is something known as the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. And generally speaking, it allows states to do things like require informed consent or set limits on to the extent that anatomical gifts can otherwise be made. And we generally have large exclusions for things like blood and products from blood, because we have a long history in the United States of donating blood for monetary compensation. Similar, but somewhat slightly different rules when it comes to egg and sperm. Eggs essentially need to be donated, although at the same time, lawyers have cleverly gotten around this here in the United States by compensating egg donors for their quote-unquote time, which essentially, if you want to be a realist about it, turns those donations into sales. One of the odder aspects of this is that at elite universities here in the United States, one of the major advertisers in student newspapers are for egg donors of graduates of those schools. The idea being that people will generously compensate egg donors for, again, their quote unquote time. If you happen to be a graduate of the Harvards and the Stanfords and the Yales here in the United States, something that I know is, if not outlawed, at least significantly frowned upon or found to be totally odd in much of the rest of both the United Kingdom and Europe. So it is a function, again, of what particular body part we happen to be talking about, which perhaps is an odd way of looking at it, but we have, you know, different ways of structuring gifts in that area here.
As far as I understand it, the old-fashioned view of property in the body was that property law just doesn't apply to the body because the body lacks the property requirements of divisibility and transferability. But now with modern medicine, particularly DNA and genomic medicine, that has changed, of course. What's the position in the United States regarding kidney donorship?
That generally is ruled by the lists in the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. And so to that extent, kidneys cannot be bought and sold in the open market the way that blood tissue or products from blood tissue can. And so even though one can divide it in a way that one cannot with some other organs, right, that essentially only become posthumous anatomical gifts, it's still regulated here in every state to otherwise prohibit any compensation to be a donor. We have here in the United States, I actually don't know what the comparative numbers are, but there's a not insignificant number of altruistic kidney donors, people who are trying to clear the backlog on individuals who are otherwise on dialysis and are waiting for a kidney by altruistically donating a kidney, even though it's essentially going to an anonymous person. So even in the sense that it's possible here in the United States, it's not treated any differently from some of the other anatomical gifts that are otherwise made.
That's very interesting. Thank you. So going back to the cell line situation, I just wanted to talk about the 1990 case of John Moore and the regents of the University of California, which seems to be on all fours with the Henrietta Lacks case.
Yeah. Is it on all fours with the Henrietta Lacks case? I think that that's worth thinking about. One of the major differences, perhaps, between our Moore versus Regents case and now our Lacks versus Thermo Fisher case is that the compensatory damages that were sought specifically related to patent royalties that the University of California otherwise generated. And I think it's important to note that rather than occupying an immortal cell line, the way that Lax's cervical cells did. There was a not insignificant amount of biological transformation work that needed to take place to get John Moore's spleen cells to otherwise propagate in media. And the upshot of that is that there was a lot of, to use a European patent law term, there was a lot of inventive step that went in to the technology that ultimately was the subject of the patent that originated from John Moore's spleen. There was a lot of technology there relative to the quantum of technology that was needed to propagate Henrietta Lacks's cells in medium. The upshot of that is that it was probably unfair, and indeed the California Supreme Court dismisses this claim of John Moore, and frankly, I think rightfully so. It was probably unfair for John Moore to claim that he was otherwise owed royalties from this simply because he provided the starting material there. There was a big difference between the starting material that was provided, informed consent or not, and what ultimately became the subject of a commercial sale. In Lack's case, a lot less. I mean, Lack's case was one of the first, if not the first, truly immortally propagating cell lines back in media with no recombinant transformation because such technology didn't exist back then. So given that, I think that to the extent that the remedy sought is tied to the sale of the cells themselves, in the Lax case, that is much, much closer to the harm that is complained of versus the harm that was otherwise present in Moore. I think it's also worth noting that although essentially every single one of Moore's causes of action ultimately gets dismissed by the lower court in California, that gets affirmed by California's Supreme Court. One survives, and the one that survives is Mr. Moore's informed consent claim against his doctor, Dr. Goldie, and the larger University of California. So again, I think that highlights, the Moore case highlights, that in circumstances like these, the research is essentially allowed to continue, and the cause of action, to the extent that one exists, is between the physician and compensatory claims there, not related to the technology itself. In the Henrietta Lacks case, both her treating physician, Dr. Talindi, and the researcher, Dr. Gay, both of them are long since dead. And I would struggle to imagine that there would be any court in the United States that would allow an informed consent claim to be held against the trustee of the estate of a patient versus the trustee of the estate of a deceased doctor. I think we're too far afield on the remedies question at that point for this to be anything that courts could do about. So I think there are some significant distinctions to be made between the Lacks case on one hand and the Moore case on the other.
Well, thank you for that. That's very enlightening. So significant obstacles in the way of possibly the Henrietta Lacks claim. How common is now, with the technology we've got as opposed to the technology of the 1950s, how common is the Henrietta Lacks line of cells in the biotechnology world?
These days, I would say that it is pretty exceedingly rare for two reasons. First of all, since Henrietta Lacks' time, we have found a bunch of animal models that work great. We have a bunch of murine, that is mouse-related, kidney cell models that work excellently. We have our Chinese hamster ovary cell models. We have insect cell models now. And so there is less of this pressing need for human tissue out there, or at least immortally propagating human cell lines, if we're going to exclude for a moment discussions about human embryonic stem cell lines. There's kind of less of a need for this for basic molecular biology research as opposed to things that are pertinent to stem cells or human development or things of that nature. In addition, one of the biggest innovations that we have had, and I say this somewhat sadly, is a revolution among lawyers in contract law. We have gotten so good at informed consenting, that being the verb here, patients that no one could possibly sustain a cause of action against their researchers anymore. Now, to the extent that you're going to engage in a research program, they're going to take your tissue for something. Having looked at some of these informed consent forms or waivers, they say by and large that, you know, we're going to use your cells for, you know, anything that we could think of that is pertinent for now into the future, for whatever means, however devised by human mind or technological process. I mean, it's as broad as it could possibly be. And so one way of thinking about it is that claims like this are exceedingly rare because the technology has advanced. And another way of looking at it is claims are exceedingly rare because hospitals' lawyers have gotten so good at protecting researchers and hospitals from anyone ever suing them again.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly the Californian Supreme Court in the Moore case said that if they ruled otherwise, there'd be this prospect of patients haggling with their surgeons just before they go under the knife as to the value of their tissue, and that would not be a very, very welcome future for medical research. What is your view personally about the prospects of the lax estate litigation?
I will confess that I'm skeptical it will succeed. I think there are some significant, dare I say, philosophical difficulties in linking the harm that is complained about to the remedies being sought. And usually those are grounds for dismissing a particular case here in the United States. The things that are complained about, some of which have not been demonstrated to be true, at least as of yet, and some of which I think are too far removed from the particular harm. So on the things that are being complained about, one of the allegations in the complaint is essentially that Henrietta Lacks received substandard care insofar as, you know, more of her tissue was removed than was necessary because researchers wanted to do research with it as opposed to actually treating her. Whether and to what extent that is actually true is going to depend upon what the standard of care was at the time, which generally speaking, from a carcinoma surgical perspective, was very aggressive back then. I mean, way more so than we would do now. So it very well may be the case that she received substandard care relative to what practice would be in 2021. But it has yet to be proven that she received substandard care from the medical establishment when she was alive. Yes, it's true. There was a lot of substandard care with respect to African-American patients back then. But it's not, or at least I don't think it's been demonstrated with particularity yet, that Henrietta Lacks specifically received substandard care herself. In addition, that harm, substandard care or not, that goes towards the physician's action. That goes nothing towards what the value of the cell lines are, right? And so as valuable and precious as human life is, I mean, I'll just say bluntly that at least in the United States district courts, human life is not worth $10 billion. And so to the extent that that's what the claim is going toward the value of the cells, for which there are a lot, a truly prodigious amount of intervening causes for which Henrietta Lacks didn't have anything to do with, right? It has to do with whether they indeed could be continued to be propagating and kept sterile, with the business model of Thermo Fisher, with other researchers' demand for it, with the absence of alternatives out there. All of that goes toward what the particular cause of action is seeking to remedy, and it's not clear that the amount desired necessarily touches upon that. With all of that being said, though, the specific cause of action that is listed in the complaint, again, this is the unjust enrichment cause of action, is famous in the U.S. tort world for being a malleable concept for which almost any inequitable harm seems to fit inside. One commentator, I believe the Maryland Court of Appeals, or maybe they quoted the particular commentator saying this, said that unjust enrichment is notoriously difficult to define. That certainly seems to be the case here. And the definition employed by almost every jurisdiction here in the United States is almost entirely circular. It has three elements. The first element is that there needs to be a benefit that is conferred upon the defendant by the plaintiff. All right. Maybe that's true in the Henrietta Lacks case. We'd have to think about exactly what the benefit is. Maybe it's just the cells themselves. That's possible. But then we start getting to this link between remedy and complaint later. The second element is that the defendant needs to appreciate what the benefit is. Well, here it seems like Thermo Fisher has appreciated what the benefit was. Dr. Gay clearly appreciated what the benefit was. Did Dr. Talendi? It's not entirely clear. Last, and this is where our circularity kind of kicks in, or I should say closes the loop, that the defendant accepted the benefit in a manner that was inequitable. I don't know how one defines what unjust enrichment is without also figuring out what inequitable means, but I mean that's the standard that courts use. So was it inequitable here? I mean that's essentially what this case is going to likely turn on, to the extent that we ever get to that point again. It's going to turn on this particular third element. Like, was it really inequitable for the defendant to accept the benefit, whatever it was? And again, that's probably going to go back to what medical practice was at the time, which frankly, in the cancer surgery context, was gruesome. So difficult to say, at least from this outset, that there's no way that the estate is going to win. I think it's gonna depend probably on how vigorous of a defense Thermo Fisher puts up, and I imagine that they will.
And also, presumably, the element of medical malpractice to which you are indirectly referring, that's statute barred by the statute of limitations.
Oh, yeah. And I would imagine has been for decades and decades and decades. Whether an underlying inequitable claim that is barred by the statute of actions can otherwise give rise to a told unjust enrichment claim is an open question in the state of Maryland right now. I don't know. I would struggle to guess how the Maryland courts would otherwise view this, but it is less clear cut as it would otherwise seem to be if this were just a straight medical malpractice case.
That's an excellent summary of what's happening. Thank you so much. I think we've pretty much covered all the details of this claim as it goes ahead. Perhaps we can come back to you to discuss the case if we hear any more about it.
Sure, I would be delighted.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.